mailing address when you get the chance. But you guys ready to start?
I'm ready.
All right. All right. Well, welcome everyone to the seventh episode of Fun with the FAR. My name is Patrick, your Fun with the FAR producer, and I'm joined today by our amazing host, Steve, and our special guest, Ryan Reynolds. Now, before we begin, I do have a couple of housekeeping announcements.
Patrick, that was a Freudian slip.
No,
Ryan Roberts. Did I say Reynolds?
I love it.
I wish you had the pull to get Ryan Reynolds on my show.
Ryan Roberts. All right. I've been watching too much TV, I guess, but
it's great.
But yes, during the episode, I'll be giving out three passwords that will pop up on the screen and be announced. The passwords are necessary if you're seeking CLE, CLP, or CPE credit. To get the credit, please write the passwords down. Once the session is over, please log into the PCI website and you will see a survey with instructions on how to get credit under My Certificates and Courses. Please fill out the survey in order to get credit for the program. Now, if a password or poll is not available for you, under the My Certificates and Courses, you can submit your passwords to either Ophelia or Danny at publiccontractinginstitute.com. Additionally, there may be polling questions for your participation records. We do encourage all questions and comments which may be submitted in the chat. If you have any technical difficulties, please do not hesitate to let me know. And with that, I will pass it on to our instructor, Ryan Roberts and Steve.
Thank you so much, Patrick, and welcome all. For those of you who might have just joined us, of course, about 10 minutes before each show, we have a little pre-show where we try to generate a little fun, talk about questions that you might have about the prior episode, if any topics that we're able to address in the prior episode. But it seems as of late, Ryan, we spent a lot of time just having fun with each other with trivia questions. So feel free to join us. We've got lots of cool prizes to give away. And I love to open up that prize closet and generate some fun. So welcome all to the start of episode 7. We're going to be talking today with my good friend Ryan Roberts, back by popular demand, I might add, to talk about FAR Parts 12 and FAR Parts 13. But before we do that, Patrick, let's go to the review questions to see how well our participants paid attention during episode 6. Okay, so here's the first question. Who may sign a contract on behalf of a corporation? Is it A, only the contractor's chief executive officer / president? B, any person within the company that has been authorized by the corporation to enter into a contract? C, only the contractor's chief financial officer? Or D, only the contractor's chief legal officer? What is the correct answer? People are still answering. I started this one off with a little bit of a softball, Brian.
And the answers reflect that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. You want to close the poll?
Yeah, the results, we got 100%. Everyone responded B.
All right. Now, Ryan, here's a question for you. How would a contractor demonstrate to the contracting officer that a particular individual has the authority to bind the company?
Yeah, it'd be funny if they had like some card they showed right before they signed the contract. They had to flash it to the CO. It's almost implied in your signing the contract, though, right? That there's whether it's explicit or implied, I just don't remember, that there's a certification that you have the authority to bind the company in signing the contract.
And in fact, in some solicitations, not all, in some solicitations, the government will actually have a provision in the solicitation and it asks the contractor, please identify to the government who has authority, who has legal authority to bind you to a hopefully an eventually awarded contract to your corporation. Now, the way a corporation, of course, will identify hazard authority is normally through a delegation of authority matrix, which will actually identify, and it's often my experience, Brian, is often approved by the board of directors of the company, and it'll be fairly explicit. I have seen it at times, if someone other than the person who's identified in the contract, right, or in the offer, the proposal, signs it, I've seen a contracting officer come back and say, who is this person? And please inform me as to what their actual authority is, which is good, which is a good business practice. Let's go to question two. This one might be a little harder. All right. How long must the government retain its contract files? The government, is it 3 years after contract completion, 3 years after final payment, 6 years after final payment, or 6 years after contract completion? This one was not as easy, Ryan.
Yeah, I want to know how many folks answering are government folks versus private company folks that are guessing on what the government deadlines are.
Right. Well, we did talk about it 2 weeks ago. And for those who played along and responded to the preparation assignment, they will probably get this question correct. All right. We still got people coming in, Patrick, or should we close the poll?
Yeah, so I don't know if you see the results, the results are shared, but it's we have about 43% said C, 33% said B, and 18% said D, 8% said A. So all over the board.
And the correct answer, Patrick?
I'm pretty sure it's C, isn't it?
It is C. Okay. 6 years.
I was a little nervous for a second.
Final payment. So 43% of you got that question correct. There are some requirements that you'll see that refer to when the contract is completed. Like, for example, what triggers the closeout procedures for the government is evidence of contract completion, meaning all tasks have been completed by the contractor. Final payment is important, Ryan, for a host of reasons. In this instance, final payment triggers or basically it starts the clock for the government with regard to its archiving or of records. Now, if the government is engaged in a active claim or litigation or some form of civil or criminal investigation involving that contract, that 6 year period is what's known as tolled, meaning it's frozen. The clock will not start ticking until that claim has been resolved, the litigation has been completed, including up to an appeal, and/or the civil or criminal investigation has ended. So the government has an obligation to keep those records. The other important thing with regard to final payment, of course, Ryan, is how it relates to a contractor's legal exposure, correct? And in that instance, it's a six-year time frame for that, meaning upon final payment, after 6 years and one day, if there's not a claim or investigation or litigation ongoing, the government cannot come back to the contractor and say, I want money back, or I'm going to file a claim against you. That 6 year period, again, is triggered and the clock starts ticking upon final payment of the government. Now, Ryan, of course, for the government to know it's making a final payment, the contractor has to tell them this is our final invoice. So I have worked with contractors, Ryan, where doing business with the government is a little bit different. And I have often told them or asked when issues have arisen, did you ever submit a final invoice? And they say, well, what do you mean? I said, did you ever submit to the government a document that was labeled final invoice? Because that's a requirement. And in fact, often, Brian, that final invoice is for $0. And that's okay. But you need to put the government on what's called actual notice that they know, okay, because that document is significant. And in this instance, it's because it tells the government, okay, that clock starts ticking for us with regard to keeping documents. And it also starts ticking with regard to the contractor's legal liability for any issues or claims relating to that contract. All right.
Before we do that, Steve, just one practical tip for the contractor folks in the audience as opposed to the government folks. You know, 6 years, absolutely the rule. One oddity there is under the False Claims Act, the statute of limitations may be 10 years under certain circumstances, and at least in my experience, those older documents tend to help in the defense of those False Claims Act cases. So often we recommend, even if 6 years is the requirement, consider extending out to 10 years because down the road it could help us if something goes awry.
All right, question number three. Which of the following documents are subject to disclosure under the Freedom of Information Act, otherwise known as FOIA? Is it A contract proposal incorporated by reference into an awarded contract? Is it B, personal private identifiable information? Is it C, trade secrets included in a contract deliverable? Or D, all contract proposals submitted in response to a federal supply schedule request for quotation, otherwise known as an RFQ? Which of the following documents are subject to disclosure under FOIA?
All right, it's looking like almost everyone said A. And then the rest said D.
Almost everyone would be correct. The correct answer here is, in fact, A. Because one of the things we talked about 2 weeks ago is a contractor proposal will only be subject to FOIA if it has been expressly incorporated by reference into a contract. Expressly incorporated by reference in a contract. And some people will say, Steve, well, if I'm doing research and I need to know whether my proposal was incorporated by reference, how would I know that? And the answer to that is it's normally on the second page of your award document on the continuation sheet. It'll tell you whether the government has in fact done that. Now there are benefits, Ryan, for a contractor to incorporate their proposal by reference. And you're shaking your head, yes. Talk to us about what some of those benefits might be.
Well, the most common one we see is if in your proposal you take exception to some requirement in the solicitation, that exception technically isn't accepted by the government unless your proposal is incorporated into the contract. So that's where it comes up most frequently for us.
Yeah, there might be exceptions. There might be assumptions with regard to your price. Sure. Now, one of the things we need to recognize is, although it might be subject to disclosure, what we're not saying here is that there are no exceptions that a contractor can assert with regard to the contents of the proposal that has been incorporated by reference into an awarded contract. For example, we talked about the B4 exception with regard to what the company considers to be trade secrets. It could be a B6 exception, which deals with private information. The classic example might be for that, the names of your employees, their phone numbers, their addresses, all of those all that type of documentation language in awarded contract that's been incorporated, a proposal been incorporated, can be redacted. That's why B is not correct. The government, any personal private information is exempt from disclosure under FOIA. Trade secrets, whether it's in your proposal or whether it's in a contract deliverable, are also exempt from disclosure. But Ryan, there's a key caveat there. The contractor has an obligation to tell the government that they are submitting documents that might include company trade secrets. And they need to tell the government what those restrictions are at the time of delivery. And that's important. And then D, of course, is wrong because it says all contract proposals, whether the contractor has won an award under the federal supply schedule or has not. Again, D is not correct because only a contract proposal submitted in response to a federal supply schedule request for quotation would be subject to FOIA, only if that proposal was incorporated by reference into the awarded order, whether it be the delivery order or whether it be the task order under the federal supply schedule contract. All right. Anything else on that, Ryan? All right, then let's move on. Question number four. All right, question number four says, which category of contracts are exempt from the basic safeguarding of covered contractor information system requirements set forth in FAR Part 24? Is it A, all small business contracts? Is it B, all contracts with a value below the simplified acquisition threshold? Is it C, all commercial contracts? Or is it D, all commercially off-the-shelf item contracts? This one's a toughie. But we did talk about it 2 weeks ago.
Looking like we got 78% D. Maybe not as hard as you thought.
79% of you would be correct. Commercial off-the-shelf item contractors would not be subject to those basic safeguarding requirements that are set forth in FAR Part 24. So the inclusion of that particular contract clause that we find in 52.224 would not be included in that type of contract. A lot of people are surprised, Ryan, that contractors that are dealing in that SAT, you know, threshold level have to do this. Well, they do. Same thing with small businesses. They have they need to meet those basic safeguarding requirements. And the same thing, there's no commercial item contract exception. We're going to talk about some other exceptions today, but commercial item contractors also need to comply with these cybersecurity rules. All right, Patrick, I think that's the last question, correct?
Yep.
All right. Then, Ryan, are you ready to go?
Born ready, Steve.
All right. Are all of you ready to go? Because we're going to talk about FAR Part 12 and FAR Part 13. Okay, now FAR Part 12 is entitled The Acquisition of Commercial Items. And Ryan, one of the things that we talked about in episode one were the fundamental, the foundational guidelines for the FAR. And preeminently was contracting officers. The government is encouraged to promote the use of commercial items to help agencies meet their mission needs. So this particular FAR part is very, very important, not only for contractors who want to do business with the government because they have a commercial item, whether it be supply or service, but more importantly for our government buyers. Because again, we talked about it in our discussion about the foundations. We talked about this, Ryan, in our conversations about acquisition planning. We talked about this requirement with regard to market research. The FAR tells us you buyers need to promote commercial items. Now, the one of the questions that come up often, and it's gotten a little bit more confusing over the last, I'd say, 5 to 10 years, is what exactly is a commercial item, right? So Ryan, if you could kind of talk to us briefly, because of course the definition is found in 2.101, but I'm hoping that you can kind of give us a base nutshell as to what's the best way to identify what is or what is not a commercial item for purposes of FAR Part 12.
Yeah, it's funny. At times it's a harder question than you'd anticipate, but high-level commercial products and services are things of a type sold in substantial quantities in the commercial marketplace. That exact thing doesn't necessarily need to be sold in substantial quantities, but something like that thing, just available. The easiest way I think about it, you can walk into any store, pull it off the shelf and buy it. Or I guess now we should talk about apps, right? You go into an app and get it in 2 days, right? That's conceptually what I think of with commercial products. Services is a little bit different, obviously.
The and what I would add to that is a commercial item, whether it be a supply or service, is something that generally is sold to other than U.S. government customers in substantial quantities. And then there's also this comment based upon market rates. In other words, the price of this item, whether it be a supply or service, is subject to supply and demand. And I mean, back in the day, Ryan, one of the ways that I would try to help my clients identify whether something was commercial or not, and it often was because it might have been a supply or service that they didn't currently supply, but they were interested in supplying that to the government. We often would go to the General Services Administration Federal Supply Schedule and say, is there a contractor on that schedule that is supplying that product or service? Because I took the position, well, if the government has already determined that they can buy it under the federal supply schedule, which means it's commercial, then I should be able to convince someone who's buying on other than a federal supply schedule to apply FAR Part 12 and not require my client to offer it on other than a FAR Part 12 basis, because at that time we did not have a schedule yet and we did not want to operate under a other than commercial item basis. My understanding is that logic doesn't apply anymore, and that the government, including more specifically the Department of Defense, has taken a position that no, the individual contracting officer can rely on another contracting officer's determination, but ultimately it's their own. And I would love to hear your thoughts on that, Ryan.
Yeah, it's a distinction without much difference, right? Because the underlying research is the same. And whether the CO is saying, I'm basing this exclusively on it, for example, being present on the GSA schedule, or that I went to Google and searched and found a couple stores selling this or something very similar to this. You know, there's a whole process for DoD commercial item determinations, right? Particularly under cost reimbursement contracts. And that's where we see a little bit of this back and forth. But ultimately, I think the core decision-making is unchanged. What do you think? Am I off base?
No, I think you're spot on. But I think ultimately, Ryan, I would have to say, or would have to hope, that this retail psychology has changed. Because, you know, 30 years ago, a lot of contracting officers were wary of the use of commercial item procurements because it's not what they did. They predominantly ordered or procured products and services on a FAR Part 15 basis. We haven't gotten there yet, but it's coming up in a very soon episode on Fun with the FAR. And there was some reluctance. And because FAR Part 12 was developed to force the government to do something different, which is step into the shoes of a normal industry consumer, a commercial buyer, not a government buyer, which meant that certain protections that they were used to having and they felt comfortable with would go away. First and foremost, a commercial item procurement under FAR Part 12 does not allow a contracting officer to ask for certified cost or pricing data. And we're going to talk a little bit further about that in our discussion in FAR Part 15. But Ryan, in a nutshell, why would the government ordinarily want a certification like that?
Well, because if you're relying on cost data, you need the certification to demonstrate fair and reasonable pricing. When you're buying commercial items, that fair and reasonable determination primarily is based on your market research, right? This item from other offerors or similar items for other offerors. And practically speaking, at least for my commercial clients, they don't keep cost type data, right? It's just not something they have and even can provide. So I think exactly. There are a couple of reasons, but from the government's perspective, it's really the fair and reasonable pricing determination that's most important.
And in fact, Ryan, I've actually had conversations with clients who were just breaking into the government business. And I would say, how did you build up this price? And they would kind of look at me, they'd be the head tilt and go, well, it's what we thought a buyer would agree to. And I'm like, well, there's no like buildup or a direct or indirect rates and blah, blah, blah. And they go, I don't understand what you're talking about. This is, we've looked at what our competition uses and we try to be just a little bit lower than that to appeal to our commercial customers. The government contracting officers traditionally want to know, Ryan, not necessarily what your actual costs are to build something or to provide a service. They want to know what your profit margins are. And in a commercial environment, a contractor is never going to reveal to a buyer, this is what my profit is. And case in point, right? I'm sure all of you may have done this. You've got some work to be done at your house. Or you've had to have a car, your car fixed for some reason or other. It's no different than if you were to go to that painter, right? Or to that mechanic and say, can you tell me the profit you're making on the job I'm asking you to do? They're going to go, no. And if you said, well, I'm not going to do it until you tell me, they'll say, hit the road, right? So it's a different world in commercial items. And the government made a decision here that particular protection, certification of cost or pricing data, or asking for cost data was not necessary to protect the government because pricing is based on competition, number one, and number two, market forces, right? The second thing that the government often will require in an other than commercial item contract that is prohibited in a commercial item or contract is a requirement that a contractor agree to be subject to the cost accounting standards. And the FAR is very, very clear. FAR Part 12 is very, very clear. The cost accounting standards do not apply to a commercial item procurement. Ryan, tell us why the government should be comfortable with that.
Yeah, it goes back to you're not billing for your individual costs, right? You're not doing a buildup. You're not submitting monthly invoices for costs incurred. You're selling a thing or a service at a fixed price. So the rest of it just is unnecessary.
Now, although the cost accounting standards don't apply, if you are providing a service on a T&M basis, a time and material basis, and we're going to talk a little bit about this particular type of contract in our discussion of FAR Part 16. You're charging the government for labor on a commercial labor hour rate, as an example, $100 an hour. Or Ryan, in your example, $550 an hour for your legal fees, right? I know you don't charge that much. I'm just laughing. The material element in a T&M contract has some form of cost reimbursement. But the government's saying here in a FAR Part 12 basis, a T&M contract, government, don't ask the contractor to be subject to the cost accounting standards, but do ask for actual original receipts to support whatever material costs they claim that they are submitting. And the government also tells contracting officers that whether it's the number of hours that have been charged or the material costs that have been incurred, that you ask for that to be certified as accurate, current, and complete. That's ultimately what the FAR Council said should protect the government with regard to the rates or the material costs that are being charged, but cost accounting standards, not so important. The last thing that makes contracting officers nervous, especially if they've never done a lot of commercial item procurements, is this whole concept of using commercially industry standard terms and conditions. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later, because there are some special terms that are very unique and should only be used on a FAR Part 12 basis. And we're also going to talk about some terms that should only be used in a contract at or below the simplified acquisition threshold and at or below the micro purchase threshold. But they're different from the way the government has done work before. And the reason why the government and the FAR Council and to some extent Congress made these decisions is because they wanted to include this vast number of supplies and sources of supplies that were only being provided by commercial contractors. And the probably the best example why Congress reacted, Brian, you know, back in the 1980s, is this whole concept of if the government needs a hammer, why do they have to issue a special FAR Part 15 procurement and have military specifications for that hammer, when if they just went into Lowe's or Home Depot, that hammer could do the job? And what they found out is that hammer, when they use these normal government, other than commercial item procurement procedures, the hammer cost, you know, $400, $1,000, $1,500. And congressmen used to come into the floor of the House or the Senate and say, I went to Home Depot and look at this was $15. Why are we wasting money? So that was the reaction. And I think to some extent, Ryan, again, especially with regard to services, since a lot of these processes and procedures were put in place back in the 80s, the government has benefited substantially. To the point where I'm not sure if you know off the top of your head, Ryan, but we're talking about now billions of dollars that are being spent on a commercial item type procurement.
Yeah, I think schedules program alone, obviously the most significant commercial item vehicle, but schedules alone was just about $40 billion last fiscal year. So yeah, you're absolutely right. And before we go, just one quick note on the commercial services piece, because it's a particular interest to me right now, because I have two GSA audits going on, and this is an issue in both of them. Contractor friends, if you're selling commercial services to the government, but don't sell those same services to commercial entities out in the open marketplace. So essentially you're relying on that of a type language in the definition of a commercial service. Then the government can reach in. So GSA is reaching in and asking for cost buildups that, to your point, Steve, didn't exist previously, right? They said, this is what our compellers are selling per hour. And that's how we backed into our pricing. So just be aware, even if you're selling commercial services, if you don't sell them out in the open marketplace, you can be required, at least in the context of an audit, to do a cost build and provide some of that cost information.
Now, Ryan, with regard to a minor modification, right, where the government is asking for a product and the base form of that product is commercial. And one of the examples I always used in the past was a laptop. You know, the government would say, I'm looking for a laptop that has all the features that the standard Dell laptop might have, right? So it's a brand name or other type specification. But then they added on, but it needs to be ruggedized. It needs to be able to be sturdy enough where if it's dropped off a Humvee or it's subject to certain maybe temperatures, that I need that too. Now, in the past, minor modifications like that, how to ruggedize it, might be sufficient to keep it within the bounds of a commercial item. Has that changed at all?
So there's a little bit of quirkiness right now with the definitions, right? We switch from item to products and services. My argument has been, no, the fundamental requirements don't change. If the modification is so unique that it's so specific to the government, that there is an argument that it's no longer commercial, you're developing something to spec. But at least I've always argued, even the minor modifications that kind of do relate to a government spec still keep us in the realm of a commercial item because the core product you're selling hasn't changed. It's still a laptop, whether it can withstand a drop from 30 feet or whatever it might be, right, doesn't change the core functionality.
And remember, if you recall, one of the things that the government is required, and this was in our discussion about acquisition planning, when it comes to a commercial item or a commercial item component, the government has an obligation to try to minimize its needs to the extent where the commercial item will meet its mission needs. They have an obligation to do that. So if they're over-specifying something, if you receive a solicitation or you receive a draft RFP, and it's initially scoped out as a other than commercial item procurement, take a look at that specification and actually bring it to the attention of the government. Is that actually needed? Or is there a way for a commercial item that you might have that can meet the government's needs? And if you have that fact and you bring it to the attention of the government, they have an obligation to hear that. And I would say, I would take the position, Ryan, and oh, by the way, they would have to take the position that, yes, if a commercial item has been identified to us that meets our needs, then they have an obligation to change the type of procurement to a FAR Part 12 procurement. And if they don't, you call good lawyers like Ryan before you submit your proposal and challenge the solicitation on its face that the type of procurement the government has identified is not correct. And to some extent, that benefits the contractor as well as the government, because commercial item contracts have benefits to the government with regard to economy of scale, with regard to efficiencies that can't be ignored.
And Steve, just one point on the minor modifications too, because this comes up all the time for us. We're talking about commercial products and services, not COTS, right? So if COTS, no minor modifications, commercial products, particularly minor modifications, okay, subject to all the caveats. So just keep that in the back of your head, folks.
Exactly. Hey, Patrick, let's go with the first password.
All right, perfect. So our first password of the day is Charles, C-H-A-R-L-E-S.
Charles. Charles.
I think I know where this is going, Patrick.
You think? You can almost anticipate what the second password might be, but don't say it out loud.
Okay. There's a wild card, I'll say that much.
All right, so Ryan, in the review question, we made reference to a commercially off-the-shelf item. How is that different from a standard commercial item?
Yeah, so it's kind of what we were just hitting on, right? Like the commercial item determination gives you a little bit of flexibility, of a type, substantial quantities, marketplace, et cetera, et cetera. TOTS is specific. It's just the thing. No modifications, no nothing on top of it. You walk into the shelf, you buy it, you take it home. End of sentence, period. That's at least conceptually how I keep them segregated.
Essentially, there's no change. What is already on the shelf or in your warehouse that you sell to your commercial, to other than U.S. government customers. And yeah. I use that. That is a term of art because, Ryan, there has been some confusion with regard to a commercial item with regard to the type of customer. The FAR Part 12, and also it's also addressed in the GSA FAR Part 8 regulations and the GSA acquisition regulations, that a commercial item, an item that is sold to a state government, for example, or a item that is sold to an international government or to an international organization, can be deemed a commercial item under FAR Part 12 or FAR Part 8. But the government is saying, as long as it's someone other than the U.S. government, that's a base requirement. A commercially off-the-shelf item is something that has not been changed. It's what's already in the market. There's already pricing that has been provided, and you can probably show a catalog or prior sales for that item. In that instance, Brian, the government's hard-pressed to say it's not commercial, because I think that one is a slam dunk. Because you're saying, no, we already offer it, and this is the pricing. Now, the government will often ask contractors selling items under FAR Part 12 with regard to price reasonableness, because every commercial item procurement has to be evaluated, and the only required evaluation is price and past performance. With regard to price, the government will often ask, well, here's you offer me a price, but, and I know it might be subject to competition here, but they also might come back and say in their solicitation, provide us with evidence or indication as to how much you price this to other customers. And one of the quandaries always there, Ryan, is the contractor doesn't want to identify the exact customer name. And the government, from my perspective, shouldn't have to ask for the specific customer name. What I've often done is come up with a category of customer, and maybe category of customer A, category of customer B. And in my working papers, have the information to support that. And if there ever is an audit, that would be subject to government audit, but the government shouldn't be asking specifically for customer names in the private sector, because some of these private sector customers don't want that information to be revealed. And that information, Ryan, is often subject to a non-disclosure agreement with that customer that it not be revealed. All right. We've talked a lot. We're unwinding a lot of things. We talked about COTS versus commercial items. Let's talk a little bit about why commercial items, Ryan, are special with regard to the solicitation process and the evaluation process and the award process. We've already talked a little bit about this in our section on publication and acquisition planning. So I'm going to offer this I had fun with the FAR stress guy. To the first person who can tell me, how many days is the government required to publicize a solicitation prior to issuance of the solicitation? How many days does the government have to provide notice of a anticipated solicitation? Let's see who was paying attention a few weeks ago.
These guesses are all over the place. This sounds interesting.
All right. I don't think I've seen a correct answer. Have you seen the correct answer yet? I'm scrolling down. How many days notice? Not how many days does the proposal, do you need to keep the proposal period open?
I think all I right, see you it
know
in
what?
There.
You know what, Ryan? I haven't seen a correct answer yet.
Oh, I thought I did, but maybe not.
All right, I'm going to 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. All right, Patrick. The correct answer is 0. Because the notice, the publication, the synopsis of the procurement for a commercial item can be issued on the same document.
Steve, we got a winner.
We got a winner.
She said it twice, but only one prize.
Yeah, Melissa
won. One prize, didn't they said it twice.
All right, so who won, Patrick?
It was Melissa.
Congratulations, Melissa. If you recall, that particular document, a solicitation for a commercial item, is actually titled, Ryan, synopsis/solicitation for commercial items. So it's the same document. All right. Now, some of you, I think, might have been a little confused because I'm seeing 30 days, 5 days.
90 days.
90 days. If you recall, with regard to receipt of commercial item proposals, right? I think the general rule, Ryan, is to keep it open for 30 days, right? But again, that's subject to the needs of the government. But the important thing to understand is a commercial item is built for efficiency and speed. In a normal course, Ryan, the synopsis goes out, this is published the same day as the solicitation, and the government is going to say, I want your proposals back very, very quickly, because it shouldn't be a big deal. Matter of fact, the FAR Council says with regard to technical proposals, Ryan, normally a commercial item technical proposal is going to be what your standard product literature is. It's not going to be something that you need to recreate. That's not always the case with some of the larger commercial item procurements, Ryan, but the government said, you know what? Government, don't make it hard for these commercial item suppliers. Keep it simple. Of course, with regard to the time frame for submission of proposals, it's often dealt with regard to how complex the procurement is. We talked about, Ryan, in our discussion of FAR Part 5, for example, if you have a commercial item procurement that might involve multiple subcontractors and a prime needs to put a team together, that might take time. And the government needs to take that into consideration. What we all need to remember, and I will state again, if you have been provided a commercial item, either a request for proposal or a request for quotation under a federal supply schedule contract that's subject to FAR Part 12 that you believe is too short, it's incumbent upon you to tell the government as soon as possible that you think it's in the government's best interest to keep that time frame open. To keep it open. Because there's nothing in the regulations that says the period for proposals cannot exceed X. It's a minimum, not a maximum. Important to note. And again, it's the benefit of the contractors and to the government. And if you are a contractor asking for more time, you need to prove to the government why it's in their best interest to do it, to keep that period open for a longer period of time. Okay. Thirty-day minimum for receipt of offers. It's the exception to the 30-day rule. Use a past performance. We talked about evaluation. Ordinarily, most FAR Part 12 procurements, the evaluation will be subject to price. Is the price submitted reasonable? Not lowest price, but is it reasonable? Is the offer, the supply or service, from a technical perspective, is it compliant and meets the government's needs? And past performance. The only requirement is price. Past performance and technical, although important and encouraged, the FAR Council says it should be evaluated. Contract type, Ryan, for supply. The government under FAR Part 12, fixed price or fixed price with economic price adjustment. We're going to talk about that special type of contract in our discussion of FAR Part 16. Cost reimbursement contracts, Ryan, under FAR Part 12 are verboten. They're prohibited. The government should never have any cost reimbursement terms and conditions in a procurement for a commercial item, supply, or service. With regard to service, the government can use a fixed price contract. But if you are a contractor that traditionally provides a service to the industry, your commercial customers, on other than a fixed price basis, bring that to the attention of your government customer and explain to them that it's not commercially standard for this service to be provided. And explain why. Otherwise, the government can purchase it on a time and materials basis. And if there are no materials needed, and all you need is labor, the government has an opportunity to purchase that on a labor hour basis. In each instance, the type of contract, to the extent you don't think it's appropriate for that supplier service, bring it to the attention to the government as soon as possible. Don't complain about it after you've submitted your proposal. And why is that, Ryan? You're laughing, you're smiling.
Because then I don't have a job.
Because?
Well, then you can't protest it. So typically we do them hand in hand, right? We file our protest around the same time when we submit the proposal. Submission of the proposal for protest purposes is important to establish standing that you're a real offeror in the procurement, even though you're filing a pre-award protest, right? Before the due date for submission of proposals, but do them around the same time. And if we're going to protest, let us protest first and then submit your proposal right after.
And I will say, Ryan, a tip to the sellers out there. If you have concerns about the procurement, you place yourself in a wonderful position. If you bring it to the attention to the government early, you provide them support as to why you think your position is correct. And then if the government ignores it, then you inform them, We're very interested in this procurement. We don't want to challenge this procurement, but we think you're not acting in the best interest of the federal government. And we are going to consider protesting this procurement because we feel that the procurement on its face is not proper. So we respectfully request that you consider our proposed revisions or changes. And again, Ryan, all these are wonderful pieces of communication that in the event there is a protest, you bring that to the attention of the third party adjudicator as well. Whether it be, we haven't gotten to this yet because we haven't gotten to the section in the FAR that talks about disputes and appeals and protests, but it could be at the agency level, the Government Accountability Office, or the Court of Federal Claims. You bring all this communication to these third parties and say, hey, we tried, we explained, and they ignored us. Okay. With regard to quality control, if you're providing the government with a commercial item, you don't have to create a quality control system any higher than what you currently offer in your standard day-to-day basis. You don't need to comply with special government inspection requirements, or you shouldn't be using any government tooling to measure things, because again, if to me that says on its face, if you need a government tool to measure something, then you're not operating in the commercial space. With regard to evaluation of a commercial item proposal, one of the important things to note is, as in an other than commercial item, you need to inform the contractors up front, what is the basis for our evaluation? And then follow it. Don't ignore it, because that opens yourself up to potential protest. You need to tell the government or the contractor, we're going to evaluate X, Y, and Z. The FAR Council tells buyers, Ryan, that it's in their best interest to use best value evaluation procedures in a commercial item. Why not just low price?
Because there are a number of factors that are super important in addition to the low price. So talking about warranty, limitation of liability, quality of the thing, if there are any quality differentiators. So anyway, there are a number of factors that should be included on top of price, where it may be worth the value to the government to pay a little bit extra to get a 10-year warranty as opposed to a 90-day warranty.
When I worked at the Pentagon, one of the things that we constantly try to train our contracting officers and contracting specialists is to utilize best value, because it provided them with greater flexibility. We tried to explain to them to avoid mathematical type evaluations. We're going to get a little bit more into that in our discussion of FAR Part 15 price evaluations and evaluation of offerors. Try to give yourself some flexibility. So then when your decision, your award decision could be challenged, you can say, well, you know what? We took a lot of things into account and we weighed all these other factors other than price, and we came to a decision we think is in the best interest of the government. And oh, by the way, here is our price reasonableness determination that takes that into account. Contracting financing on a commercial item basis. As a general rule, the government is not permitted to pay in advance of receipt of the supply or receipt of the service. The reason why I bring this up, Ryan, is it's not uncommon in the commercial world for a commercial seller to say, I need money up front at the time we sign the award. Case in point, if you're doing some renovations at your house, the builder might say, at time of award, you'll pay X percentage of costs, or X percentage of our fixed price. The government's going to say no. There are a few exceptions, but they're far and few between. Classic commercial item exception, Ryan, is a magazine subscription, right? Or some form of licensing for the use of a software, where the standard process procedure for that is to pay up front, and you'll be covered for a period of time. Technical data rights, Brian, tell us a little bit about how that's different from a other than commercial item procurement. What's the norm or standard technical rights that a contractor will be required to give the government in this type of procurement?
Yeah, it, as a general rule, the assumption is that any commercial items, typically we see this with the software, right? Commercial software, the assumption is that commercial software was developed exclusively with private funding, and therefore the government gets the same commercial rights in that software as everyone else that buys that exact same license. So that's the default position. I will say, at least on the software front, oftentimes the government does require some modification to that commercial software to work in a government ecosystem, whether that's additional security, additional features, whatever it might be. So to the extent those additional features or add-ons or tweaks, whatever, are developed using government funding, that's when we get into dangerous territory. That's where we have to have some negotiation around what rights, licenses the government gets specifically in that add-on as segregated from our base commercial offering.
There's a standard presumption that any item that's provided to the government has already been developed at the contractor's expense. And that's an important fact. We're going to talk about why that applies even in an other than commercial item basis in our discussion of FAR Part 27. But that's an important fact. The government acknowledges that. Before you got to us, you've already developed this for a commercial item customer. So we don't have any rights to that. The important thing is you explain to the government in your proposal, what is it that you will permit them to do with your product or your software, and what those limitations are. And those limitations are normally in your standard licensing agreement. And that license agreement is going to be incorporated by reference into your contract with the government. And as a general rule, it's your standard commercial licensing agreement. But there are exceptions that the government will tell you up front that at the time of the award, there are certain terms in this particular standard license agreement that will not apply. And one of the things I found fascinating, Ryan, is if you look at a standard, like for example, a Dell laptop equipment license or contract, or a Apple licensing agreement, or standard commercial off-the-shelf software, it'll actually have a paragraph in it that says, if you are a government customer, the following number terms and conditions will not apply to you. So they've already built it into their standard contract, this exception that the government accepts. And there's special terms and conditions that the government is required by law to not accept. And the classic example has always been, if your standard term and condition requires a buyer to indemnify the seller for damages that arise from the use of the product. In a federal government procurement, that type of provision, an indemnification provision, will more often than not be stricken. And it's based upon a particular statute. And I'm going to give an advantage to some of the PIT folks that have either, Ryan, reviewed the workbook and or have actually looked at FAR Part 12. And it's also in FAR Part 13. What's the particular statute that prohibits the government from accepting a general, broadly written indemnification requirement? What is the name of that statute? All right, we got a winner right off the bat. The correct answer, of course, is the Anti-Deficiency Act. So that is Catherine. Catherine, congratulations. Would you rather have the Decade of Fun t-shirt, my standard black Fun with the FAR t-shirt, or maybe the I Had Fun with the FAR Stress Guy? Let us know which prize you want, and we will we'll get to you as soon as you can when you give us your you send to us your mailing address. The Anti-Deficiency Act. Ryan, what are some other terms the government won't normally accept?
Yeah, it's
enterprise user licensing agreement.
I'll tell you the one that gets our government friends on the line here really riled up are automatic renewals. So say you pay for Microsoft Word on an annual subscription basis, you pay, maybe $50 for the year to use Microsoft Word. You can't have a provision in your EULA that says come January 1st of next year, that's going to renew. We're going to charge you another $50. That's the one that most commonly, the limitation liability important. Don't get me wrong, but that's the one, that automatic renewal that really gets our government CEOs fired up.
If we could, we could do our second password now, that'd be great.
Absolutely, Patrick.
All right.
What could it be, Patrick?
Our second password is Schulz, S-C-H-U-L-Z. Again, it's Schulz. All right.
Okay, Ryan. One of the things that I always tell government contractors that predominantly work on a other than commercial item basis. And now they're like, you know what? I think I want to jump into this commercial item pool, right? I would probably say the only gotchas or the only significant changes that need to worry about is with regard to potential issues or exposure, because they're operating in a world where they're much more subject to exposure in the other than commercial item, is the terms and conditions that are set forth in the instruction for offerors. And they're found at 52.212-1. And it's important. I always tell those folks, if you could do a side-by-side of the instruction for offers, there are some differences. And vice versa, if you are a commercial item contractor and you traditionally use, you're operating on a under a FAR Part 12 contract and you're moving over to the FAR Part 15 world for other than commercial item or FAR Part 14 sealed bidding, those instructions are going to be different. And I could probably spend another half hour identifying what the specific differences are. The key difference that always jumps out at me is when you can withdraw an offer. Okay. Now, under a FAR Part 12 procurement, you can withdraw an offer before award. Under a FAR Part 15 or other than commercial item procurement, you can only withdraw up to the point of the proposal due date. Big difference. Big difference. So if and when you get an opportunity to do that, and I would suggest if you do a lot of commercial item contracting, because people don't read this section, but it's important. So a lot of great information in 52.212-1 instruction for offerors. Please do that. Ryan, with regard to terms, because there are special terms. At 52.212-4, which is for fixed price commercial item contracts, and 52.212-4 Alt 1, which is for services type contracts procured on a commercial item basis. To the extent that you haven't spent time looking at those particular provisions. And I would say specifically, if you've never operated or worked or offered a product or supply to the government, make sure you take time to review what those terms and conditions will be. Because they're going to show up, Brian, in section I of your solicitation. And it's just going to say 52.212-4. And that's all it's going to say. It's not going to identify what it is. That is a critical term. That's a critical contract clause that you need to understand. Because it's those terms and conditions are going to be different from your standard commercial terms, because the government has kind of created quasi commercial terms, Ryan, right? But what could a contractor do? They're looking at 52212-4 in their contract, and something just doesn't look right. It looks inconsistent with what industry practices is for that product or service. What can they do?
Okay, you call me again. I love this. You're drumming up so much business for me, Steve. This is great.
But why would they call you?
Oh, because we can, if you have a commercial item solicitation that incorporates non-commercial terms, particularly if there's no rational basis for those commercial terms, the non-commercial terms, we place a phone call first and say, hey, would you kindly please revise the solicitation to remove the non-commercial terms and conditions? Then if we have to, we can protest it.
Now, why should the government respond to that though, Ryan?
They shouldn't want to include non-commercial terms, right? The entire point is you want to get as many offers offering their standard commercial terms, get better offers, lower pricing, et cetera, et cetera. The more you tack on non-commercial terms, the more commercial contractors are going to jack up their pricing to accommodate those special requests. So it's in everyone's best interest not to have these non-commercial terms.
The government buyer has an obligation to what's called tailor some of these standard provisions at 52212-4 to what is custom industry practices. And the FAR Council says, specifically states that this obligation exists. One of the things that we need to bear in mind, and a lot of this should pop up in the market research pre-solicitation stage, Ryan, is this dialogue with the government buyer as to this is how we do things in this particular industry. This is why 52212, this term, might not be appropriate. That is a wonderful subject for a contractor to have as the procurement is being built and shaped. Oh, by the way, I went through 52212-4 for you, government, and I'm going to provide you a side-by-side as to what the actual language is in the regulation, in the contract clause, and here how this is how it differs in industry. That is a very powerful tool for the government buyer to have. Help your government buyer to understand this particular process. But also bear in mind that there are specific terms and conditions that the government cannot change, that they cannot tailor. I'm gonna go and give I'm feeling very, very generous today, Patrick. Another I Had Fun with the FAR t-shirt to the first person who can identify for me one of the many terms and conditions that cannot be changed other than indemnification. And the reason why I bring that up is it was actually one of the questions in the preparation assignment. And I also want to give this prize to someone who has not won a prize before. Let me know when you see your correct answer, because I'm seeing.
Oh, we have one
service,
right
not
away.
The Service Contract Act.
We had one right away, Steve. I think it was Miriam, right?
Miriam Invoicing. Okay. Congratulations, Miriam. You just won yourself an I Had Fun with the FAR t-shirt. Now, Ryan, someone made a good point. Someone brought the changes clause, right? That is very unique to commercial item procurements. And it's not unlike the changes clause that I've seen in my clients' commercial contracts, but it's different from the standard government contract. The standard government contract states that the government can make changes to the contract unilaterally, but with the understanding that any additional costs that arise from that unilateral change will result in potentially increased cost or extension of time. In a commercial item contract that contains 52212-4, the government may only make a change to the contract if the contractor agrees. I'm hoping some of you are out there are going, what? The contractor can say no? The answer to that is yes. In a commercial item contract that contains the standard 52212-4 changes clause, the contractor can say no, and the government is, they can't force you to make the change. It's a different world. Another significant difference between a non-commercial and commercial item contract is limitation of liability. The government in a commercial item contract can tell the contractor, yes, you will be subject to limitation of liability. You very rarely ever see that clause in a FAR Part 15 procurement, Ryan. And in the commercial space, it often, limitation of liability is always disclaimed. I don't think I ever drafted or approved a contract in my commercial business, Ryan, where we agreed to accept consequential damages. And in the event we did, it was always capped. In the government space, it says you're on the hook. And I've often had my commercial clients look at that and go, see, we can't agree to that. We don't want to do business with the government. And the way I was able to walk them off the ledge is to explain, as a general rule, what the government is saying is you will be on the hook for any additional costs that the government incurs. And often that is simply reprocurement costs under a termination for default. The only instances where the government might seek remedies greater than that, again, this is from my experience, Ryan, would love to hear from you, is if there's a finding of fraud or some type of other criminal liability where the government's going to say, no, you're on the hook for that as well. But it's not one of those instances where if the government, if you for some reason breach your contract and the government has an impact on another contract and the government has another impact on another contract and so on and so forth, and they're all connected. The government, my experience has never said, oh, and by the way, you also need to pay me for those damages as well. That's highly unusual. And I think that's not the intent of that particular clause. But to the extent you have not, I would encourage you all to look at 52212-4 and 52212-4 alt 1 if you provide services on a, you provide services to the government. The other point I will make with regard to that particular section of the FAR is the termination for default, I'm sorry, the termination for convenience provision. The termination for convenience provision specifically tells the government the contractor is not required to support its costs based upon the cost accounting standards, and they're not required to support their costs with other than the accounting procedures they have in place in their commercial business. Don't ask for more and don't expect more. Don't expect them to create some new formatting for you. That's an important thing to state. And I will often, Brian, when I'm representing commercial item subcontractors to a non-commercial item prime, I will often use that termination for convenience language in my contract as part of, in my contract with the non-commercial prime. Because I want to make, don't flow down this non-commercial item termination for convenience clause to me. I'm not going to accept it, but I will accept this. And I very rarely have ever had someone tell me the government doesn't like that clause because the government uses itself. And they would have used that for, if they came directly to me for that service. That's just a tip. All right, let's jump into FAR Part 13, which the FAR Council has identified as entitled Simplified Acquisition Thresholds. And to some extent, they are. The simplified acquisition procedures include contracts at the simplified acquisition threshold, which currently is $250,000, with some exceptions for specific types of work, mostly dealing with nuclear or biological or radioactive type materials. The micro purchase threshold, $10,000. And I'm just kind of laying that out up front because we're going to be talking about the two of them. The expectation, Ryan, is the government buyer can use these simplified procedures because there's less financial risk, right? There's not as much exposure, so we don't need as many requirements or controls. FAR Part 13 also starts a new subchapter in the FAR, subchapter C, which is entitled Contracting Methods and Contract Types. And that's what we're going to be talking about for the next few weeks, or months to some extent. So the stated purpose for simplified acquisition thresholds: reduce administrative costs, improve opportunities for small businesses. Keep it simple, lower dollar thresholds, greater opportunity for small businesses to provide products or services because of the smaller nature of deliveries to some extent. Promote efficiency because it's fast. Working on a simplified acquisition threshold, we're going to talk about, can move very, very quickly. Not a lot of bureaucracy, not a lot of written requirements. And also the stated purpose is to avoid unnecessary burdens for agencies and contractors. The FAR Council states very clearly, one warning to buyers: we know you might like to use simplified acquisition thresholds because it's really, really good for you. But what we don't want you to do is basically break down requirements below $250,000 just to take advantage. You cannot do that. The actual need cannot be greater than $250,000. So you can't have multiple $249,999 ad infinitum and thinking, okay, it's okay. Someone's going to catch up and then say no. And the reason for that is some of the competition requirements are different. Some of the evaluation requirements are different. So the government, the FAR Council is saying, you know, that you might be exposing the government more if you start to do that. So you have to be careful. What I often like to say, Ryan, is operating under FAR Part 13 is very similar to how either one of us might procure a supplier service at home. I mean, case in point, the government has an opportunity to seek out suppliers using SAM, and the FAR Council is very, very, very clear as to, with regard to seeking out proposed sources of supply and going directly to them. The FAR Part 13 says CO must promote competition to the maximum extent possible. And that a CO may not solicit quotations from a contractor based on a personal preference, or to restrict solicitation distribution to only suppliers of well-known brands or makes. Using the government-wide point of entry is encouraged. But here's the interesting thing, Ryan. With regard to publication, same day synopsis solicitation is permitted. So to some extent, very little notice under 5.705. And proposals can be sought over the phone. right? The government can make can identify interested offerors and basically pick up the phone and say, "What? Tell me what your quote is to us. Tell us what the quote is. What are you willing to quote to us for this particular product or supply?" The important thing is, although the offer and the solicitation is over the phone, it's incumbent upon the contracting officer to memorialize the conversation in writing, because that's going to be critical to support an award decision. And to some extent, the award decision and the conversations, the written quote or the written offer is probably the only pieces of writing that you need to have in your file for a simplified acquisition threshold or micro purchase threshold procurement. You need to tell the contractor what the basis for evaluation and award will be. But unlike other types of procurements, you don't have to tell them. And here's the relevant importance for each: to say, we're gonna use price, technical, and past performance, but they're not required to say what's more important. Like a commercial item procurement, best value determination for award is encouraged. The only required evaluation requirement or factor is price. And the price analysis techniques are set forth at FAR 13.106-3. 13.106-3. And again, very, very simplistic. Often is simply, how is the pricing that's being offered by these multiple awards, by these multiple offers, how do they compare? So you're using a adequate competition type analysis. FAR Part 13 also talks about blanket purchase agreements. Ryan, we already talked about those rules in our discussion of FAR Part 8. They're no different. They can be BPAs, blanket purchase agreements can be offered on a single award basis or multiple award basis. They can only be used when the government has a recurring need, has a charge account in place, and has the has a need for multiple requirements over a period of time. It's a way to speed up the process. FAR 13.302, Ryan, talks about the use of purchase orders. Very, very similar to our discussion in FAR Part 8 with regard to the fact that the GSA schedule, when the government has a need, it issues an order, the same process. And then last, FAR 13.5 has a section called Simplified Procedures for Certain Commercial Items. This used to be a prototype, Ryan. If I was a fairy godmother for a day and had a wand, I would slip this into FAR Part 12 and take it out of FAR Part 13. But to some extent, it's interesting because the FAR 13.5 procurement will allow a contractor who doesn't have a schedule to potentially encourage a contracting officer to utilize this, because again, it can be quick, can be fast. You're using FAR Part 13 procedures for a commercial item, and not have to go with all the bureaucracy of the FAR Part of the federal supply schedule or a standard FAR Part 12 procurement. There are special terms and conditions for simplified acquisition threshold for contracts below the simplified acquisition threshold that are even less restrictive than a commercial item procurement. It is important, and I've done this, Ryan, when I've had someone issue a FAR Part 12 contract and it's below the simplified threshold, I've told my buyers, I would rather have you use the FAR Part 13 terms and conditions. You shouldn't have to use the FAR Part 12. We've had some good conversations, and often they're willing to do that. So to the extent you can do that, I recommend that you do so. And again, do a side-by-side of those two terms and addition clauses at 52.212-4 and at 52.213. Make a determination from there. I believe, Patrick, it's time for our last password.
Yes, sounds good. Our last password is hometown, HOMETOWN, hometown.
Okay. All right. Well, Ryan, thank you again. This takes us to the end of the show.
And well, thanks for having me.
I'm looking forward to seeing all of you 2 weeks from now. Hey, Patrick, quick question. Who was our NCAA bracket winner?
The NCAA bracket winner was Lisa LaFave.
Okay.
By a lot. She won by a good amount, too.
It might be Lisa LaFave. Lisa, I understand LaFave. That you actually picked San Diego State to go to the final. Congratulations on that. Your prognostication skills are fantastic. And you just won yourself a Decade of Fun t-shirt as well. Also, for those who you have not filled out your Fun with the Far bracket, I'm going to keep the challenge open for one more week. Anybody who submits their bracket to me gets an automatic 200 fun points, which hopefully will accrue to a fun prize. And we will have a raffle of all the submitted brackets for a prize as well. So I'm looking forward to hearing your responses. Those of you who have already submitted, I love what you've provided to me. It's very, very insightful. So until we see each other 2 weeks from now, work hard, play fair, and go farther. Thanks for joining us.